You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the October 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. We'll begin by finishing Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt in T0Z. More vintage radio tidbits. The SW54 is an All-American 5, AA5, style radio, meaning that it has no power transformer and is inherently dangerous to use or work on without at least an isolation transformer, as half of the AC line can be present on the radio's chassis essentially at all times. Most AA5 receivers are housed in wood or plastic cabinets, which helps to isolate the line power from the user, as the two don't mix well. This radio is housed in a metal enclosure, which has to be isolated from the inner chassis through the use of several rubber mounting spacers and a fitted cardboard back cover. Getting the chassis in and out of the metal cabinet is tedious at best. At least the rubber insulators seem to be in good shape. Once out of the box, I saw that the inside of the radio was pretty much the opposite of the outside. The outside was clean and well cared for. The inside was dirty, melty, and marked up. A previous owner, perhaps the original owner, felt the need to write the various vacuum tube numbers in bold letters right on the once beautiful copper-clad chassis with a large permanent marker. Yuck. Thankfully, acetone and a cotton stick swab wiped it right off. The top of the chassis was very dirty, perhaps even sooty. I immediately wondered whether the unit had been in a fire or had caught fire itself at some point. The underside of the chassis, it was a melted mess of wax capacitors, heat-stroked resistors, and electrolytic caps of dubious parentage. After cleaning, I clearly will have to test the value of each and every part, and probably have to replace most of them. It's a good thing that the radio is rather simple, even if it's wired in the messy haywire style of the day. Restoration? Begins. After tracking down the user service manual online, which always seems to look like a photograph of a photocopy of a mimeograph, I started tracing the parts around the first big mess, the 35W4 rectifier diode and its funky split heater arrangement. Part of the heater is tapped to provide power to the dial lamp, all the while providing some measure of current inrush protection. Even in that golden era, it seems that the motto of many radio companies was, "Don't do anything properly when you can get away with a cost-saving hack." Sound familiar? The area is a melty mess of oversized electrolytics and melted or overheated components. Originally, the large yellow multi-section electrolytic was the only game in town, but during a previous repair, someone added the blue capacitor after cutting two leads that originally went to Old Yeller. They were all getting in the way and would be replaced with comparatively tiny new caps, so I carefully cut the metal mounting collars so I could move them away from the giant mess around the rectifier tube socket that they were obscuring. Tracing the circuit and matching physical parts and junctions is a challenge. My first takeaway was that National Radio Company soldered parts to the unused socket pins on at least the 35W4, using them as handy tie points for other parts of the circuit. The schematic shows 5 active pins on the rectifier socket, while all 8 pins had parts and wires connected to them. It took me a long time to figure out that the extra parts weren't connecting through to the tube itself. Wow! The haywire construction, added to the many cut corners during design and assembly, didn't exactly match the warm and fuzzy feelings I have for the venerable company and its products. especially when I note that the SW54 cost a bit more than 700 inflation-adjusted dollars. Earth to Kirk, this is not a well-built radio. To get around those whopper junk electrolytics, once I moved them out of the way, I added a terminal strip to an existing nut and bolt that I had recently purchased from Tube Depot. The strip will house the four discrete caps that will replace the old multi-section whoppers, which are surely defective. After the new strips arrived, I found my bag of terminal strips that had been stashed away for years, of course. The new caps are tiny by comparison. They're also quite junky and will be replaced with Nikkesen or Panasonic caps on order if the SW54 proves to be repairable by me. One potentially critical thing I have yet to check is the rough-looking audio transformer. I haven't yet checked it for continuity. It could be burned out or it could simply be super dirty. Time will tell. I also can't safely apply power, even through the dim bulb tester, until all of the wax caps and obviously burned resistors are also replaced. With a layered haywire construction, this is a bit like building a ship in a bottle. Where's my spaghetti tubing? Work on the SW54 continues. Work on the S85 will follow. I have a hunch that the Halley is in much better shape and is probably a better radio overall. After all, it's twice the size. It's not an AA5 type design, and it cost twice as much, 1,400 inflation-adjusted bucks. Your first steps. Want to restore a radio or two yourself? Are you already dabbling in the lost arts? Although by no means exhaustive, here are some first steps and some points to ponder. My thanks to M. Caldera's YouTube channel, Electronics Old and New, for providing inspiration and a trove of valuable restoration videos and how-tos. Mr. Caldera lives in paradise on Madeira Island, a propagation vortex where the bands are always open for DX, an autonomous region of Portugal in the Atlantic, straight west of Morocco. Electronic parts and supplies often take weeks to arrive on the island, but I guess it's so beautiful there you don't really care. First, get or build a dim bulb tester. As detailed here last month, get this so you don't fry yourself and you don't fry your vintage radio. And when I say radio, I mean any piece of vintage tube gear. Do not simply plug in a 50-year-old radio and casually flip the power switch to the on position. Without the current inrush protection afforded by the dim bulb tester, and the tester's ability to slowly ramp up the AC supply voltage, which lets the ancient capacitors get squared away, among other things, your vintage radio may quickly become truly unfixable. Be a lazy Susan. Some experienced restorers build rotating cages so they can easily flip a radio's chassis upside down and right side up to make testing and restoration work easier. The lowest common denominator here is a wooden lazy Susan, a rotating round platform often found in kitchens. To make the many back and forth operations on the bench easier on you and on the radio, be picky. Don't simply dig into the first vintage radio you see at a flea market or garage sale. Be picky. Make sure the unit holds your interest. Evaluate the overall condition. It doesn't have to be a beauty queen, but it's not a good idea for beginners to start with ancient radios that look as if they've been sitting at the bottom of a well for 100 years. Choose something that catches your eye, and that also seems to be practically feasible for you to restore, learning as you go. Look at the back. Is the cover present? That's extra important for transformerless radios, as the back keeps fingers away from high voltage. Missing pieces? Some missing pieces can be scrounged or fabricated, but if major goodies are simply not there, perhaps you should save that radio for another day. Major missing pieces might include power and audio transformers, IF cans, tuning dials, etc. Speakers. Is the speaker present and intact? Surprisingly, repairing damaged speaker cones is pretty straightforward with coffee filter material and fabric glue. Who knew? Redoing voice coils is much more daunting. And remember, many old radios essentially place the audio transformer, high voltage, on or at the speaker, meaning that you shouldn't necessarily operate the radio without the speaker attached, or that the speaker can't simply be replaced with any old 8-ohm speaker that you have on hand. Existing mods. Look for signs of modifications, glamorous or otherwise, potentially inflicted on the radio by previous owners. You'll be surprised by ingenuity and atrocity before long. Similarly, many radios have factory-installed parts that aren't always on the schematic. These parts may have solved problems during assembly, but didn't make it to the technical department, or didn't arrive there until after your unit was built. Haywire construction. Unfortunately, the standards for electronic construction back in the day are often quite shocking. On the SW54, parts are haywired in several layers, making testing and repairs extra challenging. Parts may have long leads and unfortunate routings that tend to encourage signals and noise to bleed through from section to section, something we'd never want to do today. Was this somewhat insane? Well, I say yes. Stuffed capacitors? If you're restoring a museum piece or a radio that's extraordinarily worthy of extra special treatment, it's possible to stuff modern parts inside the cans and shells of obsolete parts to keep the exact look and feel of the period. This isn't always as difficult as it sounds, but it is very time-consuming. For most radios, the SW54 included, nobody will ever see the new parts because they're on the bottom side of the chassis, and getting the chassis out of the radio is a real chore. Relocate parts. In a similar vein, because modern parts are often tiny when compared to the old parts they're replacing, it's often easy or even beneficial to relocate them. For example, in the SW54, the original large 4-section electrolytic capacitor has 3 sections devoted to filtering the B+ DC voltage at various points, plus 1 small section that is installed in the audio output. Is it a good idea that the original design had the audio capacitor in direct proximity to the B+ filter caps? Probably not. But because the new audio stage electrolytic is microscopic by comparison, installing it at the audio output tube is now easy. Be sure to note your updated schematic when you move stuff around. Axial or radial? Many old-school capacitors from the vacuum tube era are axial types that have torpedo-shaped bodies with long leads coming out each end, axially, as on an axis. While most modern units are built for use on printed circuit boards and have radial leads, shorter leads coming out one side of the device. Leads aside, a capacitor is still a capacitor, but you may have to get creative when replacing axial caps with radial caps. If, after carefully bending the radial leads into an axial approximation, and the leads are now too short, you may have to solder lead extensions to bridge the gap. Spaghetti or heat shrink? And if you're worried that the new soldered-together leads are going to look ugly or become at risk of short-circuiting something else under the hood, don't worry. In these haywired environments, almost every part will need its leads covered with spaghetti tubing or heat shrink tubing to prevent shorts. Heat shrink tubing is widely available, although for tube circuits, I recommend finding stuff that's a bit thicker than usual and is rated for voltages that are much higher than those found in an Arduino circuit. The businesses that supply radio restorers and guitar amp techs still sell spaghetti tubing in a variety of colors, but you can also carefully strip the insulation off a piece of existing wire, scavenging the now hollow length of insulation for use as spaghetti tubing. This works fine for lengths of 1 to 4 inches, but not so well for longer lengths. Isolate your test equipment. An isolation transformer, by itself or as part of a dim bulb tester, can save you, your radio, and your potentially expensive test gear. Without isolation, if your transformerless radio is plugged into the wall socket, along with your oscilloscope or spectrum analyzer, for example, when your probes touch down on radio parts, there's a good chance that you'll instantly fry the front end of your scope or analyzer, as an unwanted full power connection has just been made through your expensive gear. Isolation is the key, but you can also stay safe by using test equipment that's designed to handle that much power. Vintage radio, vintage test gear. I have a Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter, VTVM, detailed in previous columns, for wrenching on old gear. You can also use battery-powered test gear that, because it has no connection to the AC line whatsoever, can't create a short circuit of that type by itself. Be extra careful, though, because it's easy to unknowingly create a bad isolation incident by connecting external gear, coax connectors, that may already be connected to the AC ground or neutral wire through its own grounded chassis. Then, still, boom! Another way to protect expensive test gear is to configure it so that it doesn't require a direct connection to potentially unisolated circuitry. There's a lot of signal floating around inside most vintage radios. So instead of directly connecting your spectrum analyzer, for example, you might simply make a contact-free signal sampling loop that, when placed near the oscillator in question, will still acquire a big signal despite having no direct connection. Attaching a similar loop to the output of your signal generator when placed in close proximity to the circuit being tested or aligned will also produce a big usable signal with no direct connection. Test and replace tubes. Surprisingly, tubes are not as fragile and failure-prone as we might think. Some restorers rarely need to replace vintage tubes, although it's handy to have access to a tube tester. If you're lucky, your radio club will have a tube tester person who has expertise and a tester. A dirty little secret is that not all tube testers are created equal, and not all tube testers can accurately test all tubes. This can be quite a rabbit hole, and expert restorers have favorite testers for sure. To start, however, substituting tubes or finding a local tube tester person is probably best. I have acquired a couple tube testers over the years, but it's ironic that the tube testers themselves need to be restored and aligned before I can use them to restore and align my vintage radios. Info sources. The internet may be chaotic and disruptive, socially and politically, but it's a gold mine of useful information when it comes to restoring vintage gear. When looking for schematics, manuals, advertisements, and even detailed restoration videos, simply doing an online search with a variety of related search terms will likely turn up piles of information. As always, you'll have to separate the wheat from the chaff, but that's always been the case. As mentioned, YouTube is where it's at for restoration videos, training, and even specialized information. Mr. Carlson's Laboratory is must-see TV, as is M. Caldera's Electronics Old and New. Consuming the many videos from those sites alone will take you from raw recruit to first lieutenant in a jiffy. Phil's old radios at antiqueradio.org should also be on your short list. Manuals and schematics. User manuals and even service manuals for radios old and new can be found on the internet. Some require site memberships for access, and some require payment prior to downloading. Many are free, however, and many paid resources can be found free with extended scrounging, potential copyright issues aside. There is also a lot of bad behavior by certain manual sites that try to trick you into paying for free materials or to download malware along with your material. Be careful. An excellent site and organization dedicated to preserving old gear can be found at radiomuseum.org. Photos and histories for thousands of models can be found here, often with schematics and manuals. If you become a paying member, you will get better and faster access to resources, but most materials can be downloaded free, even if it takes 2 or 3 days to accommodate the site's free pages downloaded per day limitations. For European radios, nvhr.nl has a similarly huge collection, but membership may be required. Other Eurocentric sites include doctsf.com, electrotanya.com, that's electrotanya.com, and electronica-pt.com. In general, while some are glorious, many schematics and technical materials for vintage models are confusing and or poorly reproduced. For example, wafer switch diagrams are interesting, but I find them to be mostly hopeless. Some materials are copies of copies of copies, so degradation is the norm. These big sites often replace existing materials with better quality versions as they become available, thus providing a valuable service. I grew up looking at ARRL schematics, many of which, last 30 years, have been drawn by Dave Pingree, N1NAS. When this is your standard, most other schematics, vintage or otherwise, pale in comparison. That's just the way it is. If you can figure them out, vintage schematics and manuals are quite interesting. They often include the dreaded dial string diagrams and weird dummy antennas that you connect to the radio's antenna input terminals before starting alignment. This is an adventure in and of itself, so don't worry about getting started. There are lots of friendly vintage gear restorers at reddit.com, groups.io, and at other sites that are devoted to this part of the hobby. One of the best can be found at antiqueradios.com/forums. Make a folder. As I search for manuals, schematics, tips, tidbits, and restoration videos pertaining to a particular unit, I add everything to a dedicated folder so I can keep everything in one handy location. I download the YouTube videos to the same folder, so if they disappear from the internet, they don't disappear from my library. This generally requires third-party YouTube downloader software, which is widely available. If you're a paid member of YouTube, you may be able to download stuff without getting creative. We'll finish the short remainder of this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.